Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to our Thursday afternoon sessions of Sunstone. I hope you all had a good lunch. This is session 153, and we're going to be discussing the importance of the sex life of the common earthworm in the early Egyptian First Dynasty funeral rites. No, wait a minute, that's not right. It is section 153. It's titled Church for the Unchurched Revisited. Please silence your cell phones. As you listen today, we invite you to explore what it means to be part of the restoration tradition. What does the history say? What does the theology say? At this conference, we encourage you to explore what it means to be associated with the Mormon movement. We ask you to reflect on your own Mormon interactions and to hold the good and the bad together to create a full, more full, complete, and personal narrative. In doing this, we allow others to do the same. Also, if you haven't signed up for our free conference app on WOVA, instructions are in the printed program. It's a good way to stay up to date on announcements, promotions, and more. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please consider purchasing Sunstone merchandise to support Sunstone, including tradable lanyard pins with your favorite prominent figures in Mormonism. There are also a wide variety of popular Sunstone chapsticks, mugs, bags, and more. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both the audience and the presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for their session. A little about this session. For the past 3 years, John Hamer has built up a new community at Toronto Center Place, committed to a five-point mission. Invite everyone into community, continually learn and grow, abolish poverty and end needless suffering, pursue peace and justice, and five, live life meaningfully together. Regular participants at Center Place include a vast diversity of backgrounds and beliefs, from Mormon to Protestant, Ethiopian Orthodox to Quaker, from Ms. Mali backgrounds and beliefs from Mormon to Protestant. Whoops, I just read that line, didn't I? From Islami to Sunni Muslim, as well as Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, agnostics, humanists, and atheists. Hamer will outline the formula for the Toronto Center Place and creating connection communities. John Hamer serves as pastor of the Toronto Congregation in Community of Christ and was co-creator of the Congregation's Toronto Center Place facility. He serves in the priesthood office of 70 in Community of Christ and is the president of Zionito, the church's Toronto-based social housing charity. He's also a pretty good guy. And now I'll give you John Hamer. At the conclusion, there should be time for questions. If you have a question, we'll ask you to come up to the microphone and ask your question into the mic because this session, as I mentioned, is being recorded. John?
Thank you. Well, a few years ago, I was at Sunstone at the University of Utah, the old venue, and I gave a presentation that it was entitled Church for the Unchurched, where we were talking about what was an entirely theoretical model, something that we were intending to launch and kind of get into, that I personally, was thoughtfully and prayerfully approaching, but assumed it could work, you know, so you're kind of experimenting and thinking. But what we can show now is what's happened since we founded the community, and both kind of our growing pains and learning from it, and what's worked, and what was completely unexpected. And so hopefully this will be an interesting presentation for you all. As was mentioned, my name is John Hamer, and I serve as pastor of the Toronto Congregation, which means essentially branch president. We have a little bit different understanding of Community of Christ in terms of bishop as a financial officer, so it's not quite the same that way. And I serve as a 70 in Community of Christ and a bunch of other hats, because once you start saying you'll do stuff, you get a lot of callings. So I'm also historian for the church for Eastern Canada and the social housing charity, and et cetera, et cetera. So I'll mention, so by background, I'm a seventh generation Latter-day Saint who grew up in the LDS tradition. I left as a doubting teenager, specifically over the issue of gender equality in priesthood ordination. And I spent most of my adult life as unchurched, as we're kind of talking about that here in terms of church for the unchurched. And so then I am a convert, an adult convert. At the age of 40, I got baptized on April 6, 2010 to Community of Christ. And I'm likewise a 14th generation an American, and I'm an adult convert to Canada. And so I'll say in 2004, when a certain re-election happened, we decided, we're moving to Canada. And we actually did. And then by the time 2008 rolled around, everyone's like, oh, see, you shouldn't have moved. You shouldn't have moved. And I'm like, well, you know what? My planning is longer than just a four, eight-year kind of thing. And so guess what? Anyway. Okay, so like I say, we talked about this as a theoretical model a couple years ago. Now there's a functioning reality in downtown Toronto. And I want to say that there are actually a whole lot of folks around in churches and Protestant churches and things like that that are interested in this formula. Actually, Toronto is very religiously diverse, and I talked to leaders of the local Sikh Gurdwara who are also talking about, you know, how do they get their young people to be engaged. This is a very big issue. When I talked to my friends who are rabbis in terms of the Reform synagogues, anyway. So lots of folks are working on this formula of younger people essentially not engaging in traditional religion. So why are we looking at it? What's the need I want to look at? I also, though, want to step back for a second and say, what is religion/spirituality? In a lot of cases, we, as a society, maybe have been writing this off, but maybe before we throw the whole thing out, we should look at it a bit. What is the model that we developed, and can that be replicated, or is it just a one-off that we're doing something that requires, for example, me to be there? So our overall system is called Creating Connection, and we just advertise it here. I'm very visual, and so I'm also, in addition to my background as a historian, I spent a lot of my career as an advertising director, and so I always have logos, and when the mission is being read, there's icons for each one of those, and so again, these are all built into that five-point mission of the puzzle piece, and you, who are being invited in, is the piece we're missing to build this community, right? So anyway, you can also find out about the program at our websites. So we always start, just start a ritual in Toronto Center Place when I'm having one of these meetups with our mission, because sharing mission is one of these kind of ritual things that if we kind of say it together, we understand and build identity. And so as we've said here, it is invite everyone into community. So it's that first plus piece that you added. And we're an inclusive, affirming community. So we have the rainbow flag out on the front sign, abolish poverty and needless suffering. So we mentioned that one of the ways that we do that, we're an activist community. So we've been able to, even though we have a very tiny little congregation and most of our facility is not that big in the downtown of the city, nevertheless, we are able to operate three social housing apartment buildings, and we're building a fourth, because if you live in the city, you know that the problems of housing injustice, underhousing, and homelessness are very serious, and so we want to pour a lot of our effort into that, and I've been privileged to be able to serve as the as the volunteer chair or president of the board for the housing charity, and I was able to have a major project where we took one of the old towers and was able to get all the sprinklers put in, which is something I'm very, very, very happy once it was they were all in and all that we were praying all the way until we got it in anyway. And same thing, very happy to build a new one. We also, our other charity that we have is about sustainable development worldwide. And so, for example, World Accord, which is the Canadian Church's international charity, for example, we have a partnership in rural Nepal where we focus on women's empowerment because we feel that that's something that not all charities are able to focus on, things like LGBT refugees and things like that, but where we are at as a church, we can make those kind of focuses, and we think that that is where, for example, women's empowerment is where you really break cycles of poverty. Pursue peace on earth. One of the ways that we do that in Toronto, we have a program called Encounter World Religions. We just had our Discovery Week 2 weeks ago. People come in from all around the world. We live in the world's most religiously diverse city. We go and we visit all of the different religious leaders. We employ a religious studies professor who academically teaches you about, for example, Buddhism or the Sikhs or there's actually two different types of Buddhism there. Anyway, and then we go to the Gurdwara and we actually meet the people. So we kind of feel like in this period of time where there's a lot of there's synagogue shootings still, even if you can imagine, I feel like, in this day and age, that one of the ways that we can pursue peace is by breaking down barriers of bias that come from ignorance, right? And finally, or not finally, this is number four, continually learn and grow. And so one of the ways we do that is through our meetup that we'll talk about when I'm talking about our program, but our History, Theology, Philosophy group, which we also stream every Tuesday, and living life meaningfully together. And so forming community in order to explore spiritual practices, share ideas, and without it being dogmatic. So essentially that's kind of how we took as founding principles, and we repeat them, and in order to make a community so that we're all sharing them. We don't all, we're not, it's not, it's a principles-based, right? So this isn't about I'm making a bunch of thou shalt nots and everybody has to be on board with this list. We interpret all of these kind of basic ideas and how do you feel called, you know, personally to embody them in different ways. And as you see, they're kind of there's a kind of a general sense of them and you can embody them in all kinds of different ways. So, for people in the church business, it's a little different for the LDS church, but it's still, you know, tracking in this direction. In terms of surveys, and we always in Canada, we always say what the survey is in North America so that we can include U.S. and Canada together, right? So if you are coming from that prior to the baby boom, the greatest generation, 60% of people say they're active in a church. If you are from a baby boomer generation, 40% of people say they're active in a church. If you're in my generation, Generation X, 20%, and if you're a millennial, 10%, right? So this is total demographic collapse of an institution that had been, within just two generations here, had been central to North American life, and now it's going to, you know, it's almost down to nothing, right? So why? There's all kinds of reasons why that's happening. So I'm going to suggest my own reasons why I think. So I think traditional religions in North America have promoted dogmatic teachings that fail to stand up to scrutiny and that also maybe lack relevance. Maybe there's something that we were talking about in 1830 and it seemed real relevant to everybody then, but how relevant is it now, right? They place extreme emphasis on ideas like sexual morality, and these are ideas that are actually based in the culture as opposed to anything else. So it got fixed in the 20th century. They're actually widely, you know, wildly out of step with contemporary practice. Obviously, the intrusion of components of religion into politics have turned a lot of people against that. One of the things that the separation of church and state does, not only does the separation of church and state create freedom of religion, it actually separates religion out and frees it from all of the sausage-making mess that is the state. The state is going to do stuff you don't like, and the state is going to do stuff that is, you know, and so once the religion is intervening and trying to make you do stuff as the state, then that also is quite, has a negative connotation for people. And most recently, as we've seen in things like the Hobby Lobby case in the United States, the religious right fundamentalists have claimed religious liberty is, in order for them to have religious liberty, often you have to oppose equal rights for everyone. So it's going to be, if I'm going to me to exercise my religious liberty, I have to be able to say, you know, I won't make a cake for you or whatever for your wedding, that kind of thing. Okay, so I think, though, in the wake of all of this, as we're seeing our local institutions collapse, religion, there's a fundamental problem that exists. And so my little equation here, if we have something like we have society, and we have the individual here within society, and there is a sense, I think, that's general among individuals today in terms of disenfranchisement. So if we were going to put the individual on a scale, and you're going to put on the other side, you know, these kinds of mega corporations like Amazon or somebody like that on the scale, or if you're only thinking in terms of your government, if you're not thinking in terms anymore of being on your school board or being on the, you know, any kind of thing that you're actually accessing locally, and you're only thinking only in terms of the presidential race, you know, the national government or whatever, government is the presidency, then, you know, the balance here is so out of whack because of where you're at. You have to have a big magnifying glass to see how important an individual is in comparison to the mega wealth and size of these corporations. So Amazon does care about you, but only in terms of massive aggregate, right? And so you're being watched more than ever, you know, in terms of all of your different habits, but not as an individual, right? And so as an individual, you're just completely disenfranchised, and people are feeling that more and more. And so I would suggest that one of the things that happens here is the individual is massively devalued in terms of your relationship with these kind of institutions, in terms of corporations. The interest that, unless you, you know, I don't know, you're some kind of famous blogger that is going to make Amazon have a big black eye that they'll go out of their way to, you know, do something nice for you or something like that. In general, they don't care. And the relationship that you have with them is quite different than what it would have been a century ago when you're going around to your local butcher and your baker and all these kind of things where it's a local community institution that you are a part of. And that same thing is happening in terms of the size and scope of government. And so with that, you becomes disgust with the political process, there's disenfranchisement, there's disinterest in voting because, again, people are focused only on every 4 years here in the States and the one big race, and they don't even care about local building of local party or any kind of interest and that kind of a thing. So there's a massive relationship imbalance when we deconstruct all of this stuff. And so what makes a free democracy? So this is a hypothetical, so don't even think of which one it would be. So there's a free democracy, you know, on the left, and there's some dictatorship, right? There's a totally hypothetical. So imagine the president of the democracy wants to eliminate dictatorship and spread democracy. So when the military battle is won, the dictator's toppled, free elections are held, why isn't and doesn't a working democracy immediately spring? Why isn't that created? Well, you no longer have the dictator. You're having free elections, all those kind of things. What's missing? And so what's missing is that whole societal fabric of all of those local institutions, everything from being in the Elks Club, you know, to being in a civic band, to having, you know, any kind of other kind of local, being in a school board or all those kinds of things, right? And so for the past half century and more, we have been systematically dismantling all of our local independent institutions. And so I think it's little wonder so many people feel isolated, alone, disenfranchised, powerless. Independent institutions, I believe so firmly, have the capacity to leverage power far beyond the capacity of the individual. My ability as an immigrant to Canada to build a $50 million social housing tower within just a few, I mean, I've only just became a citizen in January. is just nil. I couldn't do that. You know, I mean, it's not as if I'm, unless I'm some already a millionaire, which I'm clearly not. That's not what it is, you know. And so how is it possible? It's because I'm able to be part of an institution, in this case, our social housing charity, that members of a community that I'm a part of that shares the kind of values that I have sacrificed and built and had it be there so that now when it comes to me and it's my turn to hold the baton, I am able to take, you know, again, their vision and live it out for our time, you know? And so we're able to have that far beyond what anything I could have done as an individual, right? So that's institutions. Next, religion. This isn't true for everybody who's going to be here, but for a lot of people who are in our, certainly in downtown Toronto, which is a very cosmopolitan, secular place where most people are post whatever religion they are. They're not necessarily post-Christian, they're post-Muslim, they're post-whatever. And so for a lot of them, they think religion is always a bad thing. So they see Christianists on the left here and Islamists on the right here, and they think this is religion is a force for evil and it should be uprooted and gotten rid of. And I'm just going to suggest that Mormons have a very distorted perception of religion in general, because Mormonism is its own very interesting, weird thing. And you can't help but when you have a very close experience with it and it has dominated your life and everything like that, you have a real sense of one religion and you know a lot about it. But in fact, actually, as a broader phenomenon globally, your particular one is not entirely consistent with all other ones everywhere. And so I would suggest that in some ways, if you'd grown up in North Korea, you might have a particular view of government. It doesn't mean that government is bad innately, but you have a perception of it, right? Okay. So religion historically has been a force for change in many good ways. So, for example, the Quakers, just have an amazing legacy, you know, in terms of their activism in abolishing slavery. If we go back, although you might think otherwise, in point of fact, actually, it was the Christian Church, the Latin Church, what we now call the Catholic Church or whatever, but before the schism, that eliminated things like trial by ordeal. So, whereas it would have been quite normal for knights and Germanic law and everything like that, the church was actually saying, no, that actually isn't, you know, what we need instead is to have a rule of law where it isn't about what, you know, whether who the champion, I mean, if you've seen Game of Thrones or whatever, you get the stronger person cuts the head off, right? There's been lots of positive stuff. So the whole reason why, when you maybe have graduated from university or high school before, the reason why you put on a medieval cleric's outfit with a medieval priest hat, you know, I mean, what does this hat come from? So this is what medieval clerical robes. So why does that? Because obviously the university system itself and indeed science are all descended from the medieval church. It was all medieval church equals all scientists in the Middle Ages are all the monks. They're all that's where it, and nuns. Okay, and I'll even mention here that even though we can just have to tell this really quickly, even though this is usually used held up very badly. So this story of Isaac and the sacrifice of Isaac, and this is told even apologetically within the Bible itself. It's told as a tale that you have to have blind obedience to God, and that's somehow good. So that's the way the story is now interpreted. But in point of fact, if we actually go to the history of it, what the story was doing when it was first promulgated, when the first prophets are writing that down and spreading it, is in the local Israelite, the local Canaanite, Phoenician, in other words, Western Semitic practice, the firstborn child was to be sacrificed. So child sacrifice was the norm. It continued to be the norm, for example, among the Carthaginians and things like that. So what is this story? This story is a story that's introduced to end the practice of child sacrifice. It's not introduced to have it be a test of faith or anything like that. What it's saying to people, yes, you've thought all this time that Yahweh or Molech or whoever the God that is the God that requires the firstborn of every womb is mine, saith the Lord. That's also in the Bible. Instead, now you're able to have a substitute, which is to say a ram. And now maybe we're not all too into killing rams and animals and all that kind of thing right now. It's a pretty big big improvement, if you think of it from back that time, over baby killing. So I would say that that's actually an introduction of religion as a force for good at the time, or a religious reform as. And so what is religion? If we are taking just this idea, there's religion, and then outside of it is not religion, and we draw a dot, dot, dotted line or whatever, what separates religion from not religion? So what is inside, what's outside? And so in some sense, where we are right now, this almost has the same relevance or lack of relevance as using our words that we have, like natural and artificial, where we have this idea that goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks that anything, let's say, human-made is artificial and everything else is natural. But humans, in point of fact, have been making all kinds of things that are living and organic things, become unnatural or whatever we want to call it. I mean, how natural is it that we're evolved now to wear clothing? We are, some of us, not everybody, because some people are lactose intolerant, we're evolved to have cow's milk. There's all kinds of things that we're evolved and all of the different things in terms of, anyway. So I'm just going to say this suggestion of what it is a modern artificial thing. And that's also going to be true for what is religion and not. It is, in fact, a construct that we have in the modern era that we've put religion into a little box and we put draw a fence around it. But that fence is entirely based on our Western history and tradition. So one of the things that we do put in there then, based on our experience in the West of Islam and Judaism and especially Catholicism and Protestantism, is that what is in there is belief in and activities related to God or to gods, right? But the problem with that is that leaves outside of our box, certain amazing things. So Buddhism, I think by most people's understanding, is one of the major world religions, and yet it's a non-theistic religion, or at least originally it was. When it made its way into China, it became theistic again. But if it's about God, it wouldn't have been anyway in India. And same thing, there are Unitarians who have church, who can be atheists. There are atheist Hindus. Actually, Hinduism can have everything in it, including atheism, And so in point of fact, there's all kinds of things that are definitely religion that don't fit into our Western conception of this word that we've made. So isn't religion always a profession of belief, faith in the truth, doctrine, and authority based on feelings? It's especially true in the Mormon context or Utah Mormon context, right? And you can read and have feelings about the Book of Mormon to know whether it's true or not, rather than other kinds of evidence empiricism. And I'm going to say no. Although we have maybe brought ourselves to that place, we think that it isn't always that way, it hasn't always been that way, and it certainly doesn't need to be that way. So I mentioned that we go to these, we have this Encounter World Religion Discovery Week. And so one of the things that we do when we do go around and visit everybody, we do native spirituality. And so we go and visit First Nations, as we say in Canada, the American Indian in America, First Nations elders who talk to us about native spirituality and practices. And so this particular elder was telling us a story that when he was going around trying to recover what their religion was, so the fact is that after so much cultural imperialism that the First Nations people have endured in the last five centuries, he has to feel like, okay, I need to go around to every elder, male and female, in my particular nation and ask them, what is religion? And he went around and asked, what is the word for religion in our language? And the response from all those elders was, we had no word for religion in our language. What we now call religion in English had been for us all-encompassing in our activities and our worldview. So everything that they do, the idea is that when you're fishing, when you're weaving a basket, when you are doing anything, that all of those kinds of things are part of how they understood what their religion is. So it's holistic and whole life focused, right? And so he said that we don't have that word. So this is that's part of, even as we are recovering our native spirituality, we have to deconstruct this thing that you guys have imposed on us, right? So what he didn't realize, though, actually is, and actually most of us don't know that, is that English, in fact, prior to the Columbian Exchange, also had no word for religion. And so I'm a medievalist, so I said the modern era, as far as I'm concerned, is 1492 onward. And so that's recent times for me. So we came up with that recently. So we did have that word, so that word religion, that goes back to the Latin, so religio. And what does the word mean? If you were to say that in, you know, let's say the year 1200 in England, if you were to say you were religious, you're a nun, that's right, or a monk. Yeah, so a religious, specifically not even a priest, it's a secular clergy. So it means that you, the word, it meant that. And so what I'm suggesting here is that it's not that people in the Middle Ages in England were not religious, but they didn't have a word for this thing because they didn't draw the particular box that we draw right now and put it in based on our modern time and place and everything else. So, monk and nun. and I already said that. So, like many modern ideas, the newly invented conception is rooted in Western ethnocentrism. Ancient religion, just as for the Native and First Nations peoples, was all-encompassing. So when we look back to the traditional, what we now call paganism, but they, of course, didn't at the time, the traditional religions of the Near East and Greece and Rome, worship all the gods or whatever, it wasn't simply about believing in Zeus or something like that or reading texts about, you know, Zeus, in other words, scripture. It was, of course, about relationship with the divine and propriety, how you behave, but also law and prayer, divination, the calendar, writing, processing meat. So one of the things about animal sacrifice, almost all animals and that you would have eaten at all in antiquity would have been, there would have been a sacrifice, and then most of the animal then would be eaten, and that's when you do eat that. Sports, the reason why the Romans had those gladiator things and everything like that, those were religious festivals. And so it's all of those things that we have that are heir to that, the invention of comedy and drama, those are ancient Greek religious festivals when comedy is started. Parades, holidays, travel, tourism, care for the sick, care for the poor, this is all a religious activity. It is not just what you do on Sunday, where you go in terms of prayer, having sermons or something like that, and maybe a small amount of sacramental stuff, which is what we think of today. So, as North Americans in the post-war era, our experience has largely been with a religion that is a conservative force that has been, in some sense, reacting against change and social progress. And we don't have a lot of historical memory, usually, so many of us naturally extrapolate then from that experience and assume that religion, in general, has always been antagonistic to change and social progress. I'm just going to suggest that that's not true, right? Part of the problem, though, in terms of the stagnation of religion in the last century or so, is the last time, I think, organized religion in the U.S. significantly retooled itself. So in the early 20th century, the bulk of the population had essentially elementary or high school education, and the way primary education worked was through memorizing facts. Religion similarly taught through that kind of thing, so you have a Sunday school, and it's primarily about memorizing doctrine, and that is, I'm not denigrating that, that it was very satisfying to people whose worldview is informed by primary or secondary education, and so it was a wonderful way to live. However, the problem with it in general now is, since a high share of U.S. and Canadian population has attended college, and because post-secondary education emphasizes critical thinking, people have been brought up to question things like doctrines. And so if you were going to memorize a bunch of truths, the place where we're at now is, wait a second, the answer is, well, why is that way? You don't just accept anymore. And so what they end up finding is that these doctrines or teachings, they seem very empty, and they're dissatisfying. So, that said, if we look back at the past, it's not that everybody in the past, you know, were all a bunch of dummies or something like that, right? So, throughout all of time, we have had critical thinkers in the past. And so in the Western tradition, the Latin tradition, it's people like Augustine, Boethius, Anselm, Abelard, Thomas Aquinas, Descartes, all those guys. So while the majority of the population in their era experienced a very satisfying worldview through memorizing doctrine, there was a tiny fraction of the people that had been trained in critical thinking were engaged in the practice of theology, which has included exploring, reasoning out, and divining meaning. So looking at the questions behind those doctrines. And so that tradition that has continued on this entire time, the last 2,000 years and the predecessors before, is just as legitimate a component of our traditional religion, the inherited practice of religion, as memorizing doctrine. And so I'm also not denigrating the other, right? So, but the point of it is that it turns out that this particular inheritance that we've not thought about as much is the type that I think is potentially meaningful to the population who is most likely to leave religious affiliation, in other words, people who have a college education. And so what we have attempted to do, I'm just going the underpinnings of our whole thoughts here in Toronto. What we attempted to do is go away from a literalistic focused religion to a meaningful focused religion. And so in other words, instead of having a religion that answers all the questions, why, where do we come from? Why are we here? Where are we going? Oh, we have those answers, you know? And so this is the thing. Rather, we question those answers, right? We turn that around and have that. So for me, I mentioned, so I grew up as a doubting teenage Mormon. And so back in the 1980s, I had a bunch of different early influences that were involved in me deconstructing my Mormon inheritance, right? And so, for example, I had Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, right? And then so in this particular, you know, this was very meaningful to me as I was reading. So item 6 on the agenda, The Meaning of Life. Now, Harry, you've had some thoughts on this. That's right, yeah. I've had a team work on this for the past few weeks, and what we've come up with can be reduced to two fundamental concepts. One, people are not wearing enough hats. Two, matter is energy. In the universe, there are many energy fields which cannot normally perceive. Some of these energies have a spiritual source which will act upon a person's soul. However, this soul does not exist, and so on and so forth, right? In other words, this whole complicated thing. However, it's never achieved, the achievement of a soul, because of the capacity of people to be, you know, distracted by everyday trivia, and so then they immediately want to know about the hats, right? So, and likewise, another one that was really influential to me was Woody Allen at the time. So this idea that the universe is expanding, he says as a kid, and he says if it's expanding, someday it'll break apart and that'll be the end of everything. What is that your business? You're here in Brooklyn. Brooklyn is not expanding, you know. So in other words, so those kind of things. How are we going to explore life's meaning? Those are the things that made me, you know, I mean, those kind of things as I was thinking, this is not satisfying, these kind of doctrines that I'm being taught. And I didn't have the sense that I could have a community where it would be legitimate to be asking those questions, sharing ideas, and hearing what other people have to say so that they can also have me learn from them, right? So I feel like with inheritance, there's any number of things that we can do with our inheritance. I love heritage. I love history. I'm a historian. I'm a medievalist. I love antiquity, right? But that said, whether we're trying to be enslaved to our history and heritage, should we throw it away? Should we, have it be a burden that is weighing us down, or rework it, or discard it, right? And so in my neighborhood in Toronto, there were plans to do like with this plan they had for Paris in the early modern era, in the modern times. So right after World War II, they were going to just tear down Paris and build a bunch of complex like this, because it would have been so much more efficient and modern and neat to have a neat new modern Paris instead of the old one, right? And so they almost did that too in my neighborhood, which they instead preserved. And so we just have just this amazing number of these Victorian row houses and things like that. So anyway, we are very happy, obviously, that they didn't tear down Paris. So let's say, though, if we were to take these things that we have built into our idea of what religion has to be, the literalism, that it's anti-gay, that it's against science maybe, that it's dogmatic, that it's sexist. Can we throw those pieces away, and is there something that we have left that's worth saving? And so this is what we've tried to build with creating connection. So I mentioned our mission, sharing mission, we already did that. How have we done it? So what are we doing in Toronto congregations? So we produced groups, meetups, that are about learning topics that are taking that mission, live life meaningfully together, right? And so our most important meetup that we have in the course of our week is our history, theology, philosophy group. That's the one that's the best attended. People come every 7:30. Every Tuesday at 7:30, we have a lecture on a topic in that broad range, history, theology, or philosophy. That usually lasts about an hour and 15 minutes. We can go on, depending on how long the discussion. And then, from then, people stay. They're all jazzed up to be talking about the meaning of life and other kinds of things that are within that realm. And often they stay all the way till midnight, you know, and we end up having 5 hours of church on a Tuesday. And so what we've been able to do, these are members of our history, theology, philosophy group on a Tuesday night. This is actually, we had a lot of people show up, so this is more than we often have, so we've more than filled the place. But many of the people are regulars who come absolutely every week, and we built that. Another one of them, the models that we've taken is sharing spiritual practices together. So the group that meets immediately prior to the history, theology, philosophy group is our mindfulness meditation group. And so this one tracks a little bit younger. Again, a very diverse group of people that come to this as well. And some people come for both. So they come and they meditate, they share snacks, and then they stay for the theology group, stay for the discussion. So in terms of, like I said before, I kind of presented theory, and I've just represented what some of the theory was. But now I can give you some of our numbers and our models. So essentially, we're a very small congregation. You can see, like, our Sunday activity here is between 10 and 20, you know, on a Sunday, right? So that's all that was left in a 127-year-old congregation and that kind of a thing, as we were facing the same kind of serious issues that so many small churches have. And so we introduced a couple years ago, after we made the presentation here, that Tuesday lecture group, the meditation service, and those we had to build up from scratch. I may be able to have a little bit of a draw in the Mormon or ex-Mormon community or something like that, but in Toronto, nobody cares about that and that kind of a thing. And so I did the lectures, and people were kind enough to come to them even, you know, as we were trying to advertise and invite, and we slowly built that up in 2016. Through 2017 and 2018, to where the point that we have a very consistent group, people who are committed, who come every single week, and, you know, fill our space. We built a small space because this is what we felt we wanted for sustainability. So what we ended up having in 2018 is 759 people participated in one of our events, and so that means you sat through an hour and 15-minute lecture, or you meditated with us for an hour, or you went to a Sunday service. And so that's very unusual in the history of a regular Community of Christ congregation, right? So we won't have had this many new people for the preceding 50 years of our congregation in terms of people who had never before crossed a Community of Christ threshold and participated in an activity in 2018. And indeed, so what we went from, before introducing it, just to show our numbers, you know, we had had in 2015, 34 people attend one of our services that we'd had who weren't already a member or hadn't already been, and to the point where we've grown now to the, again, this is a first-timer only, 759 people. If they came back the next week, they wouldn't count on this. Or if they were already a member in some other congregation, they wouldn't count. So these are kind of the new people. How does that become a community? So, yeah, we're doing some activities. People come, they're meditating with us. So where is it? Well, I've already shown one of the things that we do is we recount our mission right at the start, and we talk about that very much so. We have it built into the wall and everything else. So one of the ways that people form identity with our community is through regular participation. They come every week. Not everybody comes every week. Sometimes one of the things that happens I said that the meditation group tracks a little younger, so we have, let's say, people in the history, theology, philosophy group. If you're in college, you don't need to go to a lecture like that and have a discussion because you have to do that as your job as a college student. But for all of those of us who liked that and liked graduate school and things like that and are now, let's say, working in the insurance industry and we don't get to have those kind of discussions, now this is a way that that's a community that they want. And so it's people in all ages, but let's say especially 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, new people from every age have come. Younger people go to the meditation, so people 20s and 30s especially, and so then they don't come as like every week, and yet they still consider it to be their group. There even in some cases, one Muslim girl, she's post-Muslim, but anyway, she tells her husband or whatever, I got to go to my church now. He says, you don't have a church. And she says, I have a church. You know, anyway, but she only comes every you know, like let's say every 6 weeks or something like that, but it's still, it's her church, right? So that just means we just need a bigger group, you know, and of people in order to have a consistent, you know, activity. So regular participation, sharing the principles and mission, right? So we say right at the beginning what our mission is, what our enduring principles are. Identity forming artwork. So we made the space so that every single component is built into it, is constantly doing that same kind of teaching that you had with the stained glass windows back in the Middle Ages, which is to say, this is what we're all about. And if you go around, you may not get it or whatever initially, but if you go around, I can do a tour and within 30 minutes explain what the entire identity of the movement and its history all the way back, you know, is. So identity forming artwork. People form identity with the community by just bringing stuff. So people, we have a snacks and sharing. People now always bring snacks all the time. That's just a component that immediately happens. Helping prepare the space, right? So we have a meditation, and it's all set up for meditation. Half an hour later, it's set up for a lecture. Everybody just, you know, starts doing that. That's not a surprise in the Mormon context, right? So you guys are used to that. Investing through offerings. So the way we start right from the beginning, this isn't just a program where the Sunday people are paying for us to do this bait and switch or something like that. It's not like that. We have right out at the front, you know, suggested donations and people throw money in the plate. And likewise, through the course of when you're giving the lecture, we talk about how this is a community that's intentional, that we have it based on everybody's contributions, right? And so investing through their offerings. Welcoming newcomers. We're very welcoming. All the people who are regulars, when somebody comes in, what is this place? What is this all about? And they immediately start doing it. It doesn't have to be me that's doing that kind of a thing. They have identity with the community. They immediately take ownership of the kitchen. So there's a bunch of folks for whom at a certain point, I'm not allowed to be doing stuff in the kitchen. Get out of here, you know, that kind of a thing. We put the kitchen right up front so that it can be part of the sharing time and that people immediately have taken that ownership. People share other gifts. A big one, we have a big library, and so people bring books all the time and give us books, but there's all kinds of other things that people bring that are important to them that are part they share with the community. Inviting their friends and family. People continuously bring new people. They're like, look, we brought someone new to the lecture. We brought someone new to meditation. We don't have that, frankly, in Sunday service, right? We don't have people, oh, I brought my neighbor. Yeah, nobody does that, you know, to the Sunday service, right? So asking for the envelopes. So they throw in every week. That's a habit. But at a certain point, they're like, I'm part of this community, you know, so I want the envelopes or I'm going to start making bigger contributions, in other words, so that they can get the tax receipt and that kind of a thing. Attending retreats. So one of the things that we have added in addition to our weekly activities is we have in the Community of Christ a tradition of owning campgrounds and this sort of thing. And so we have made use of the fact that we have that resource and organized weekend-long retreats so that members of our community and also our online community and also all the other different connection communities can come together and we can do a lot more in the course of a weekend. It's like with dating. If you go on a date, you know, and then you go away on a weekend trip, it's like 10 dates or something, right? And so in that same exact way, you're really part of the community as we've now been able to explore so many more practices and all that kind of thing together in a retreat. they themselves become the leaders of activities. So members of the lecture group, I don't have to give the lecture every single Tuesday, members who hadn't previously been involved, very close friend of mine now, Shaheen, who has an Ismaili background. She's we're Muslim, you know, background. We believe in dual citizenship, so she can continue to be Muslim and also be Community of Christ in Center Place. She values it because in her tradition, she wouldn't be able to talk about Quran and about the Prophet Muhammad in the way, because her mosque wouldn't allow this kind of open exploration, right? So that we talk about it because we're interested in history, theology, and philosophy, and so she gives lectures. So her lecture that's upcoming is a feminist reading of Quran, right? And so leading activities, asking for ministry. So it doesn't take very long, and the thing really functions just like a congregation where you're the, you know, another different Muslim woman at a certain point came to me and said, I don't even know how to ask this because we don't have this in our tradition, but I really feel like I need a pastor. Can I talk to you? You know, and so, and that's not an infrequent thing. So the same kind of ministry, as we call it in Community of Christ anyway, that happens on the Sunday with the congregation. So we've mentioned how have we done it. So in terms of our particular formula, this is just, but this is flexible. So you don't have to, we did history, theology, philosophy lecture because I can do a lecture on that. We did mindfulness meditation because Leandro, who is our spiritual formation minister, was practiced in that. So our lineup in Toronto Center Place is Sunday morning, we have our regular scripture discussion class. Then we have what we call inclusive church, which is like a sacrament meeting. Snacks and sharing, then we have a more of a theology lecture, and then we have Christian meditation, Christian-based meditation service, so it's Lectio Divina. And so I know that you guys out here got really lazy and now only go to church for 2 hours on Sunday. We now have 5 hours of church on Sunday. So we're not lazy. So same thing Tuesday. So I mentioned the mindfulness meditation, the history theology group, and then snacks and sharing that goes on, and then the retreats, right? And so you do not have to go. I tell everybody very clearly, you don't have to go to 5 hours of church on Sunday. That's not, you know, in our community. But what we're doing is we're having different ways that people are walking with us. They don't have to. They can, you know, there's any number of ways that they can be part of our community. The primary thing is sharing in these kind of missions and sharing in these kind of missional activities. And then there's closer and closer ways you can go, but then there's also other ways. We're not saying, in the same way that we stopped saying that we're the one and only true church, we also don't claim that Christianity is the one and only true religion. Rather, we claim that we have a special calling and are walking a path that we value, and we'd love for you to walk with us in as much as that is valuable to you, and we'll share in community together. And if it leads you elsewhere, then that is also, we will wish you well on your way. And so this is how we have church together while we're walking together. So that's essentially then, in addition to that, of those activities, these are the ones that we live stream. And so in our particular case, then we try to go beyond our walls. So we built a little facility so that we could have a intimate community that is our local nucleus. But then of all the content that it is constantly producing, what we're trying to do is share that more broadly beyond the walls. And so the inclusive church service, the Sunday illumination lecture, the Logos meditation, Lectio Divina, the mindfulness meditation service, and then the history, theology, philosophy lecture, they're all live streamed. And so we actually are putting out whatever that is, 6 hours of original content a week. And I just showed just as by way of results. So prior to just the first initial launch of this, in terms of our local revenue, so we're an independently incorporated charity as a congregation. And so our charity, in terms of all of its revenues, Sunday contributors in the year 2016 constituted 86%, and then people who are on staff also, there's other lion's share there in terms of giving contributions, and almost nothing from anything else, right? The second year, the first year that was really got into swing with the program, we had done a reorganization of our funds and things like that, so we were able to put our endowment into better anyway, working for us better. So it's actually providing dividends and interest. But you can see already now the Tuesday and Thursday contributors are adding to an actual component of this in 2017. And then in 2018, you can see that of the Sunday contributors are about providing about a third of local, the Tuesday, Thursday, and that's, which is to say the mindfulness meditation and the theology group is providing about half amount of contributions that our Sunday folks are. And then online, which had just barely started last year, was already providing half of what the Tuesday, Thursday folks have. I don't have the current numbers for this, but it's actually, the trend has continued, right? And so we anticipate within, for our particular congregation, within just a couple of years, in fact, that the, probably the online is going to be the biggest single component, but both will dwarf the Sunday. So from our particular community, what we've tried to do is use this as a prototype to reach out and create more connection groups. And so we have created what we've called Creating Connection, which is how we make this particular formula. We have our own connection groups that I've mentioned that are meeting in Toronto. And so there's now 23 different connection groups. Obviously, we're in Ontario, and that's where we've started the program. But it's kind of leapt across the border to Niagara Falls and things like that in New York. Church headquarters in Missouri, so they've started one down there, and then in the Western Canada. So we're starting to have, on this kind of formula of creating connection, multiple connection groups, not just the ones we're doing in downtown Toronto. So, for example, this is a meetup, a conversation group that's just meeting in a coffee shop in Independence, Missouri. Meet discussion group in British Columbia here. I don't remember where these guys... No, these guys are in Ontario. This is in British Columbia, people who are in a mindfulness meditation group. There is a First Nations drumming group that meets in Brantford. Anyway, any number of different things. So one of the things that people do is coffee in conversation or coloring in conversation. And so it's mindful conversation. You don't have to be able to do a theology lecture or something like that. But let's say when you're coloring together, adult coloring, and you have like a topic that is meant to get you thinking, you can have something like, okay, do you believe in free will or determinism? Or something like that. And possibly that you may be given some people something to read ahead of time, or maybe you haven't. But in any event, if you are all coloring together, there isn't this awkwardness when there comes silence, because you also are doing this kind of a thing. And so it creates a deeper conversation that can happen. And so there's all kinds of different ways to have missional conversation groups or any kinds of things. Any number of spiritual practices. This is another group that's doing labyrinth walking. Knitting prayer shawls together as a missional practice. So they knit together. They also can have those kind of meaningful discussions while they're knitting. They can also be sharing that skill with a younger generation that might be interested in it. And it's also for the purpose of creating a prayer shawl, which is meant to be given to people who are in spiritual need, right? So there's all kinds of different ways that it can be missional. So that's the idea of it, of creating connection. It's not just any one particular thing. Doing missional things, but especially the idea of it is together, right? And so we mentioned here that one of the ways then we build a stronger or bigger group identity is then we bring all of those groups together and we share a bunch of the practices when we go together at a connection retreat. And so, anyway, just some of the feedback from those when we had these are still very early connection retreats, so this was from last September. It was an escape from the city to connect, to learn, open to everyone. It was welcoming and fun. I'm humbled by the sense of community. There was such diversity, intergenerational bonding, the growth of these interpersonal relationships, support and equal experiences for all. I had a wonderful experience with old friends and made new ones. Loved the accepting, non-judgmental atmosphere, an amazing experience, I'll never forget it. In a world that seems full of polarization, a place of unity, where we can move past our divisions, it's an oasis in the desert. I was inspired to speak my desire and create connections in my own community, and now's the time this person decided to go back to their place, and they don't have a connection group, they went and founded a connection group. great connections made. I learned insight, openness, love, great food. I appreciated the comfort and got a lot from the experience. So it's not just a theoretical model anymore. We definitely have, as I mentioned, I think sustainable communities, meetups that are existing in Toronto and Centre Place. And now we have also launched the first set of these beyond that in the other connection groups. And we also believe this is a model that can be, you know, go forward because it's flexible and could also, though, still be around mission in such a way that it's not simply willy-nilly everything, because it can all come together to keep this meaningful identity. And so that is my church for the unchurched.
It looks like we have probably about 20 minutes for questions. So if you have a question, please come up, speak into this microphone because we are being recorded, and we want to make sure that we break out of here by 3:30. So any questions, come on up.
All right, so love what you have to say. And I'm kind of angry right now because I think for the last couple of years I've said, hey, you know, I'd be back at church if they just did a few things different. If you could walk into an auditorium and they'd be like, hey, Brother Adair, welcome. These guys over here, they're doing some experiments with this thing called tithing where they give 10% to the group to see if it helps influence things for the good. And those guys over there, they're not drinking coffee. They're going to see how it turns out. And over there, those guys are just trying to be good people and be kind and come and see if there's something that fits for you. And if you love it, take it away. If you don't, then, you know, if you want to stick around and participate or start your own club, like if it was more open and inviting like that, it sounds like I mean, I've followed your following for a long time. And it sounds like you're doing that.
Yeah.
And I'm in Utah and you're in Toronto, so screw you for that too. But, but I also wonder, I'm such, I think like my Asperger's, whatever it is, kind of makes it hard for me to come into a group and say like, you know, when you hold up the pictures, for instance, of, you know, the people that are like the hate groups, like, oh, God hates fags, you know, and stuff. And that's a really unsafe place for someone who identifies as gay to be or can be an unsafe and a triggering place. And I don't want to like engender that kind of a place, but I've also come across things like, I don't know if you guys have seen, why I, as a black man, attend KKK rallies. And I can't, as a non-black man, say like, hey, yo, you should go to KKK rallies. You'll learn a lot.
Yeah.
But he showed me as a human how going to the place that's unsafe or uncomfortable, having that courage, having that willingness to go, like, I believe that there's something human below the surface of this seeming hate and ugliness. So it's this paradox of tolerance that kind of gets a little bit tricky, but is there a place for that? Is that even something to expect or to hope for? It sounds like you guys have so many things that are open, like you have your different groups and your different sessions, and it sounds good, and yet I think there's a part of me that's broken that says, like, this doesn't actually open up all the way. I want to open up all the way where someone can come in and say, like, you know, if you have that group that says, you know, don't be a jerk, for lack of better words, it's more a conversion of like, be kind, especially to the jerks. We have room for the jerks. We have room for the closed-minded, because we recognize that there's something that as humans, we can get in deeper to our own goodness and everyone else's. And we can heal some of these things that are broken that lead to some of these things that we call ugliness. Is it radical and I guess naive or foolish for me to think that that can never exist in an ism? Or do you feel like you're tapping into that? It looks on the outside like you are, but you know, is it a false hope? Where does that stack up?
So do we have room for the jerks? Is that the one, or is
it
for is the
there,
other people?
Is there, like, because I think that it's easy to say, like, we're the good people here.
Yeah.
And lots of groups say that, and your group is saying that. And it looks like it's more true than some of the groups that I've grown up with.
Yes.
But is there, like, an upper limit of, like, you can be...
Yeah. Yeah, so there definitely is an upper limit to what how tolerance, I think, has to work. And so on the one hand, there's a when we're saying we're open and welcoming in a space and all that kind of thing, that there is also, though, something that can happen where if a person, we talked at the beginning of this about a little bit about individualism in society. And so I think that in some sense we've erred really kind of radically on going nutso with individualism. And so if a person's individualism is being limited because they have, they know that whatever, being gay is wrong in this kind of way and they just like to say it all the time. So then that is not welcoming, you know, them saying that vociferously, you know, all the time, isn't welcoming for all of the gay members of the community and that kind of a thing.
Right.
And so we haven't had that particular circumstance. We have had circumstances where, we open to all, right? So people can come in just off the street and we have regular members who are underhoused and that kind of a thing too. There was a guy, though, who was had some kind of a rant and who was getting close to, you know, it seemed, anyway, certainly if, personally, it was sort of like a personal attack kind of thing, and made it feel, you know, made many people feel very uncomfortable. In that case, I mean, I also, because I'm the pastor, I had to watch and be concerned. He did seem scary and violent and he was big. He's tall as me. I'm a bit bigger. Anyway, he didn't come back, but I would also have disinvited him, you know, because if under certain circumstances, I mean, what we try to do is work with people. A lot of times a person's brand new, they want to assure us that they're smart, you know, and so they'll be real talky and they'll talk over people and all this kind of thing. Generally speaking, there's a lot of ways you can work with people, and my personal leadership style or whatever is erring on the side of on the one hand, giving people a lot of rope, but on the other hand, of trying to being a positive example rather than through negative teaching. So rather than going up to somebody and saying no or trying to say that's wrong where you're doing that or something like that, instead try to get them to emulate, this is what the group does, we do this, and you could be doing that too, you know, that kind of a thing. And so there's one person in the group, did have to get disinvited from not being able to just overcome that over the course, but it took, you know, anyway, 8 months or something.
Yeah.
And it just, unfortunately, he's been kind of a rotten apple, and because he could never stop talking over women, he just couldn't get, he's too old to learn that women are people, you know, and this kind of thing. Anyway, so this kind of a thing. And so it just was making it uncomfortable.
So I'll sit down and leave with this, maybe, you know, reapproach. You know, and one disinvitation out of like many, you know, inclusive opportunities, that's pretty good record. I mean, I think there's probably a lot worse institutions. So,
yeah,
I think that's a positive trend.
We may have also given a bunch of cold shoulders and they just didn't come back on their own, but this is only one that we had to disinvite. Yeah.
So, my question though, I guess, is like in the evolution of like maybe in 50 years or 10,000 years, you know, is it unrealistic to think of a time when an ism can be fully inclusive with power to actually augment the thing that right now has to be excluded because we don't know how to deal with it? So I'll leave with that. But is it naive to believe in and hope for a future where eventually like total inclusion is possible with that empathetic and compassionate approach? And I'll leave with that.
Yeah. What I would just say is that when we went through our mission and we said, for example, one of the missions is abolish poverty and needless suffering, right? And so this is a thing that, when we set that up, people said, well, how can we actually accomplish this mission? And there was even Jesus said, the poor will always be with you, right? You know, but the... So the goal of it is that, yes, I have that, holding that out as an ideal. In the meantime, where we are is I feel like we're in a place where the whole societal fabric has unraveled and I'm trying to rebuild from some foundational blocks and I have to do it doing a little bit of triage. I have to access a little bit of lower hanging fruit. And so if I were to work with one person and devote all of my energy to doing that, in other words, to have that person be able to learn those lessons, I wouldn't be able to do the thing I'm doing to get to that place in the future where we have more institutions like this, where that person is fully getting the the nurturing care that they need in order to get to the, you know, be fully part of participating. And so under those circumstances, we're working as much as we can, but at a certain point, it's more than we can handle right now. But it's still an ideal.
Just wondering really quick, have you had any discussions, connections with religious leaders in some of the more conservative, older, orthodox churches around your area and how they perceive you, particularly because in some ways you're kind of a competition to them, particularly for many younger people?
So I am in a bunch of different ecumenical and interfaith groups. Nobody has identified us and see us as too big a threat because our space is really quite small. And so as a result of that, I don't think, they just think it's kind of quirky and weird, and they're like, oh, so there's like liberal Mormons who do this very weird thing, you know, because it doesn't, cause no matter how much Community of Christ might think that they're past that, you know, that's what, the, you know, when I talk to the Protestant ministers, they're like, you guys got to hear this. There's liberal pro-gay Mormons, you know, and this kind of thing. And so that's kind of what they get on the liberal side. In terms of conservatives, I guess they're maybe less aware. So, I mean, I am part of, so for example, we work together. So, for example, the Salvation Army is a very conservative Christian group that is all around us because of shelters and things like that. So we work on terms of where we can overlap in charity, homelessness and that kind of a thing. But obviously we disagree doctrinally and that kind of thing.
I have two questions, but I'll only ask one at this time.
Okay.
And then sit back down and see if I can come back up. Several years ago, there was, you know, a movement for several types of, you know, kind of churches for the unchurched. I'm aware of things like Oasis and Sunday Assembly. And I was reading an article or listening to a podcast or something that talked about how, you know, now a lot of those have either downgraded or, you know, it hasn't been the explosion that they've expected.
Yeah.
So have you kept up with other communities like this? And do you think that in the different, you know, hexagons that you had on screen that you've kind of overcome the issues that they may have faced. The thing I remember from the articles and podcasts was if you have a very strong volunteer-based group, then things will kind of fizzle out if you don't have this kind of dogmatic impulse whenever the volunteers, you know, just get tired of it.
Right.
So do you think that that's something that, you know, because there's no like commandment that this is your calling and you must do this or, you know, your eternal fate,
right,
is that a problem that you, you know, have to deal with?
Yeah, no, it's good. Very good question. So yeah, this is like we say, we're doing work on this formula, but we're not working on it alone. And so, for example, with Oasis, there's an Oasis Toronto, and they actually rent one of our Community of Christ churches and met in the afternoon and meet there. And so it's great, and we support, I mean, in the same way that I was talking about, like, working with the Salvation Army, we obviously also know them and the Unitarians and all the other great groups. So what I think is different about what we have here is that when you have a church that is specifically church without God, or atheist church, that the word atheist is, I think, ultimately a negative identity. And that's even the word itself is at its root. And I think that, like I said, that's why I wanted to even start this with this, what's religion and even what is God? And so what I think in both of those cases, we're dealing with ideas that have calcified since 1500 and specifically since the Enlightenment. And that the direction that we've come to where we, on the one hand, have a fixed, simplistic picture of God, like God in The Simpsons, who is, you know, big guy with a white beard and all this kind of a thing. And that's, on the one hand, somebody's theism, which is problematic and has all these problems of the doctrine and everything like that. This is why people have left that religion. Then also, though, having an identity that is based on, I understand and that's what God is and I don't believe in that. Whereas what I would suggest is prior to the Enlightenment and even much more recently, the word God is not so much like one image like that and things like that, but it is a variable. And so by not rejecting an open exploration of how do we find either deep meaning or, you know, if you even if you want to. There's a lot of philosophy now about relativism and these kind of things, and yet a lot of us still believe in something like fundamental human rights, Well, if you believe in something that's fundamental and universal like that, that in a sense is also not relativism, right? And so we're already working with you here. You know, so that's a variable. That can be how you don't have to use the word God. But anyway, the fact that we are open to exploration for finding universals like that, which is the umbrella of what we can call God, even though there's multiple different paths of how people have understood that throughout time and everything else. I think that that positive portion of the identity is still, you know, we haven't had to have that negative portion of it. So we don't have a lodestone that I think is around the necks of some of these communities. We're very open to having people wherever they're at. So they can be somebody who's a fairly Orthodox Muslim woman who has and also a fairly Orthodox RLDS lady who is a believer in the historicity of the Book of Mormon, you know, and they can be, and they can all be part of this community with atheists. And so I think that it's a different formula. And I think that's why it's maybe hopefully more successful than the problems that some of the other communities have had.
Thanks. So my question actually follows right into that, which okay. I'm just really curious about how you set your curriculum, who decides what the lecture is going to be,
yeah.
You know, how do you come up with your subjects for these yeah. things?
So specifically, I also want to say that doing the lectures like this is simply, you know, how an missional activity that I was able to do because I'm that's my background. So I just say, oh, this is something I can do and I want to do. And I actually, the thing that that was completely unexpected for me. So I laid out this model 4 years ago or whatever, and I said, this is what we're going to do, and et cetera, et cetera. But I'm doing it as a kind of an experiment of building a thing. And what was I thought, oh, I know how I'm sure it's going to work. I know it's going to work. But what I didn't expect at all personally is how much I was going to value it and how much this community that now has gotten created is my family and how much I love all the people and everything like that. So I wasn't expecting that component of it. But in terms of how are we deciding, for example, in our particular iteration of a history, theology, philosophy group, So for one thing, we only have, even though it's a broad topic, we only talk about things if we have themes that have relevance till now. And so I want to do, there's all kinds of things that I think are important, but I have to actually think of, if I'm going to do, like this last, the most recent lecture we did was on Cleopatra. And so if I'm going to do a biography of Cleopatra, I want to talk about women in history so that I can talk about gender role and all that kind of thing. But I have to think of how that's going to have modern relevance. Otherwise, I can't do the lecture, even though I want to, right? You know, and so that's part of it, is how can we address the themes that we've kind of already been building on? And then in general, people who are regulars say, Erjan, who is he comes all the time, he says, or actually it was Bogdan who wanted to say the next week's one. So he says, boy, there's so much going on with all this populism and everything like that and the world. And you often talk about nationalism as being a very modern phenomenon that didn't exist in Middle Ages and antiquity and things like that. Can you do something on the origins of nationalism? So that's the lecture for next week. And so it usually comes out of the discussion. But if I think of something that has relevance to now, then I throw it in there. But that's how we do it.
Second question, this may be dumb, but so the relationship between this and a typical community of Christ, kind of like, is there different, like Sundays, or is it Sunday activities, would that be the community of Christ?
So the Sunday activity that we have, so what we call inclusive church, is very traditional community of Christ. And so our congregation, people can't hardly believe it because they look at this, you know, and they say, oh, you guys are, you know, fancy sci-fi congregation. We're, we're a 127-year-old congregation. We had a reputation for being the stick in the muds. You know, we're the congregation. We in the 1890s, they called our congregation the old maids branch, you know, and so already. So we've had a reputation for being old and for, and so we have very, very traditional forms, but what we have is massively updated content, right? So it's like hymn sandwich, it's prayers and hymns and sermons and things like that, but all of the content. So it's like non-gender language of talking about the divine, and also in hymns, and there's lessons, all the peace lessons are about, anyway, So it's updated content. So that part is quite typical of a Community of Christ regular congregation, although more or less in terms of how updated the content is. The forums are pretty similar. Some of them now will have experimented in all kinds of other ways with new forums, and they're way more creative in terms of how kinds of, but it's very informal for what we would understand as our congregation, and so we would be less, we get uncomfortable with how they're doing all this kind of wild and crazy stuff, finger painting church or whatever. anyway, so they might do other kinds of interesting things so you just depends on the congregation and what they feel called to do. In terms of the other activities, so Creating Connection is a brand new program. It's a program of the Canadian church. It's spreading across Canada. It's now started to be picked up by different congregations of the U.S. church, and we're hoping that the Salt Lake congregation may want to be participating in the program. But otherwise, they might do a bunch of activities. I know they've had, for example, they've had book clubs, and book clubs could just as easily be part of Creating Connection, you know. So
we are, for all intents and purposes, out of time. Just to follow up on the last question, the last activity of Sunstone for this year and every year is a worship service. And as usual, the Sunstone worship service will be held this Sunday beginning at 10 o'clock at the Salt Lake City Community of Christ. So if you would like to come, see a little bit about what we do. Locke Mackay, who's sitting in the back, is going to be teaching our Sunday school lesson. And John, are you preaching?
I'm not, but I'm going to be doing a helping with the confirmation, so I'm very excited for it.
Okay, that's great. So please come out, and I just have to say this. The definition of God, since I've been Community of Christ, several times I've had people come that were new and say, I can no longer believe in a God that looks like you. So thanks for coming and attending, and enjoy the rest of your afternoon.
Thank you.